My name is Francis Donald, and I'd like to welcome you to this third session in an ongoing series of webinars on sacred number and geometry. Okay, as always, I'd like to begin by introducing the rest of the staff. Brett, could you say hello to everyone?
Hi, everyone.
And BL?
Hello, everybody.
BL will be assisting me in taking your questions and comments during the webinar. Okay, let's briefly review the GoToMeeting interface. First of all, if you wish to verbally participate, please use a headset. If you don't have a headset, there is a text box in the middle of your control panel that you can use to ask and answer questions. There's really only a couple of buttons that you need to concern yourself with. The main one is the hands up button that you see on your screen there. It's up in the left-hand corner of your control panel. It has a hand with a little up arrow. Just click on it once and your hand will be digitally raised. And we'll call on you as soon as we can. Okay, if you have any other questions about the GoToMeeting interface, feel free to type them in the text box, and BL and I will get back to you as soon as we can. So let's get started. I'd like to introduce a few more ideas about the number one. Unfortunately, in the interest of time, I'm going to need to ask you to hold any comments and questions until we begin our discussion on the dyad. Actually, at the end of the discussion on the number one, I'll open the floor for you to share any thoughts you might have or ask any questions about oneness. If I don't do it this way, we're not going to make it into the number two today, and I'd like to keep it moving. So thank you for your patience on this. Go ahead and type your questions in, and then BL will present them to me at the end of the discussion on oneness, and we'll answer your questions and air your comments. And also at that time, you can go live if you'd like to speak. And if any comments or questions that we're unable to respond to during the webinar, I'll respond to them personally by email because I have all your email addresses. And I'll read all the comments and questions and then get back to you. So even if we don't get to you during the webinar, we will get back to you afterwards. Okay, we'll be taking a look at a lot of different approaches or disciplines in our tour through the numbers. These will include the birth of numbers or how what number evolves into the next, as well as each number's affinity or lack of affinity for other numbers. We'll consider each number's visual geometry, as well as its color and musical or vibratory significance. We'll take a stab at interpreting the symbols that relate to the number we're studying, including those that have appeared as crop circles. This image is a digital recreation of this fabulous crop circle. This is a photo by Lucy Lamy. She's actually lives in Santa Fe and goes to England during the crop circle season and posts all her results on her website. It's just a fabulous collection. Here's another one that develops the theme of the yin-yang, which is one of the germane symbols of the number two. Anyone interested in sacred geometry would do well to stay abreast of this amazing phenomena that's been going on since the 80s. Okay, and that, we'll look at each number's linguistic roots or etymology, as well as how our numbers relate to numerology and arithmetic. We'll be focusing a lot on the significance of numbers in the ancient wisdom teachings, drawing on quotes from the Tibetan and the stanzas of Zan, both in the secret doctrine and in a treatise on cosmic fire. Related to these teachings, we'll be considering the particular state of consciousness associated with each number. we'll touch on how the rays shed light on the numbers, as well as the significance of each number in astrology. We'll be looking at how mythology reveals the meaning of numbers and the significance of numbers in ancient Greek, Egyptian, Indian, and other spiritual disciplines. We'll investigate how the meaning of numbers is revealed through the Tarot, as well as the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. We'll also look at how number manifests in temple construction. This is one of the very important temples, the Jedi Temple Library. We will be delving into mathematical functions called by mathematicians irrational numbers. Examples of these functions are pi, phi, and the square roots. We're not going to be doing any heavy math. I would be incapable of leading a webinar that did so. But rather, we'll be contemplating these functions with the goal of unmasking the life aspect inherent in them. Okay. Does this look familiar? In our last session, we considered oneness mainly in terms of its origins, symbolized by the circle with the central point. Balzac, whom Helena Blavatsky called the unconscious occultist of French literature, describes these origins strictly in terms of numbers. Could we get somebody to volunteer to read this passage? Vio, could we bring somebody in on this?
I'm looking for raised hands. I don't see any right yet.
Well, they're still in listening mode. I'm sure someone will jump forward.
Here we go. Terry, go ahead, please.
All right, thank you. God is a number endowed with motion, which is felt but not demonstrated. As unity, it begins the numbers which... Sorry, part of this is obscured for me. Mm. Oh, dear. As unity, it begins the numbers with which it has nothing in common. The existence of the number depends on unity, which, without a single number, begets them all.
Great, thank you. That reminds me, if the problem was the little window with my talking head in it, obscuring the print, there's a button up in the left corner of the GoToMeeting interface that allows you to control where that that window appears. And also, you may consider this, you can go up into the menu itself under webcams and just turn that screen off altogether, and then you'll have just the full screen slides on your computer screen. Okay, so this description is a description of God transcendent, which was the main import of our discussion on oneness in the last webinar. Now let's take a look at how oneness lives in the many, not only God transcendent, but also God immanent. We'll consider three statements related to this concept. All relate to the circle with the central point. From Hinduism, we have Krishna's statement, having pervaded the universe with a fragment of myself, I remain. Notice how this statement unifies the circle and the point by ascribing the same identity to both, to the circle made up of the pervading fragments, and to the point, a symbol for the statement, I remain. Thus we have God immanent and God transcendent described as one being and by that being. It's really one of the most remarkable statements that's come to us. From the Upanishads, we have, then he realized, I am indeed this creation, for I have poured it forth from myself. And in that way, he became this creation. And verily, he who knows this in this creation is a creator. The statement is similar to Krishna's, but with one important addition. The last phrase suggests the possibility of evolution, doesn't it? For the he and he who knows this is one of the many, which is each and every one of us. It's the promise of the path of return. And finally, from Theosophy, we have the disarmingly simple statement, I am that I am, which carries the ideas expressed in the previous two statements in five words. DK associates I am with the personality and with the level of consciousness being developed during the first or past solar system. I am that with the soul and with our current solar system, and I am that I am with the monad and the third or next solar system. So I am that I am is monadic in nature, thus working from within the realm of being, the essential quality of oneness. In my opinion, these keywords come closest to being a worded expression of our symbol. You can feel the circularity of these keywords, with the two I's representing sequentially God immanent or fragmented, and the God that remains, which is God transcendent. These keywords also demonstrate an important concept in our study, the fact that a worded passage can be constructed in such a way that it incorporates the geometry of the symbol for which it has an affinity, and thus participates in and reveals the potency of that symbol. There's no simpler example of this that I know of than the one on your screen. The old commentaries, such as the stanzas of Zahn, excel in demonstrating this particular connection, which is between prose and geometry. This is probably because Sinzar, the ancient language from which these commentaries are translated, is made up entirely of a series of geometric pictographs. By the way, this is just a fanciful representation. No actual Sinzar has ever been published because it's the language of initiates. But we hear it described in the writings of Alice Bailey. Michael Schneider points out in A Beginner's Guide to Constructing the Universe that aham, which is Sanskrit for I am or just I, meant more in the sense of I am that I am, is written with the first, middle, and last letters of the Sanskrit alphabet. Thus, he goes on to say, representing the point, radius, and circumference of a circle. So here's the same example, but in Sanskrit, of how the written word is directly mirrors the symbol. We have to always remember that it's a symbol that is causal, stands in a causal relationship to the language used to interpret it. Okay, the idea of the one inherent in the many and the many resting in the one can be arithmetically illustrated by the fact that 1111111111 times 1111111111 equals 1234567891876543211. And it's converse formula shown on your screen. This is a surprising thing, isn't it? It tickles the intuition, suggesting some profound causal root that we just can't quite get to. For instance, it seems significant, doesn't it, that it takes nine ones, nine being the number of completion, which when multiplied by nine ones gives us 1 through 9 followed by 9 through 1, thus arithmetically depicting, not proving, mind you, we're not in the business of mathematical proofs, but depicting that the many reside as potential in the one, and that oneness is the inherent reality in all numbers. I'd love to pick a fifth ray initiate's mind on the nature of the causal law behind this extraordinary numerical demonstration. Okay, Let's talk about the mathematical function or phatic expression of the number 1. But before we do that, I want to talk a bit more about mathematical functions in general, which I'll refer to from now on as transrational functions, because in their essence, they transcend the rational, lower mental use of number. Okay, if we imagine a number as having a threefold constitution, much like we do with a personality, a soul, and a monad, we might say that a number's role in the realm of data manipulation, which is how we use number every day, right, represents the lower mental body of a number's life. Using this as a premise, the transrational function related to a number, such as phi is to 5 and pi is to 2, could be seen as a kind of soul force, or that which links its lesser expression to its monadic life force. In The Secret Doctrine, HPB tells us in her notes on the stanzas that the electrical force called Fohat is the source or generating agent of all numbers. Blavatsky describes Fohat as that which links spirit to matter, the dynamic energy of cosmic ideation, the intelligent medium and guiding power of all manifestation, the mysterious link between mind and matter, the animating principle electrifying every atom into life. So we have that mysterious link, the electric animating principle, the dynamic energy, the intelligent medium. You get the sense from these descriptions of the quality of phatic energy. I'm going to make a leap here and hypothesize that transrational numbers, which remember are what mathematicians call irrational numbers, are phatic by nature. We might even postulate that they describe the laws by which Fohat functions in our three worlds. If we accept this as a premise, we can easily imagine these transrational functions playing a huge role in the activities of the Deva Kingdom. It's not difficult to imagine myriads of elementals embodying and animating the form world under the dictates of the law of Phi, for instance. We might ask the question, what is the transrational function related to the number 1? In the same way that, for instance, phi is very definitely related to the number 5 and pi is the number 2. Actually, I don't think this function is known to us as a usable formula, probably because I would hypothesize that it only demonstrates on those planes of existence untouched by duality. So how it works is hidden from us by our own inability to perceive reality on formless levels. The closest candidate we have for a transrational function of the number 1 is perhaps the infinity symbol. But since this symbol doesn't relate to number in any way that we can actually use or that we are aware of, I mean, what is infinity multiplied or divided by 2? Just doesn't work, right? We can see this symbol as a kind of knot sealing a closed door, indicating the direction in which its transrational functionality lies, but revealing nothing more. We have to go through the door before we can understand the nature of the phatic principle of oneness. Okay, let's move out of the realm of transrational functions for the time being and take a look at how oneness is symbolized in the Kabbalistic tree of life. The topmost position is held by Kether or Keter, which means crown. The crown. A description of this position sounds very much like stanza 1 of the stanzas of Zan. Remember, from last webinar, the visible that was and the invisible that is rested in eternal non-being, the one being. The Kabbalistic version runs, well, actually, let's get somebody to read this. Can we get a brave volunteer?
Okay, I don't see any hands yet.
Yep.
Raise your hand if you'd like to volunteer to read. Okay, we got a volunteer here. Go ahead, please, Trudy.
The first Sephiroth represents the primal stirrings of intent in the Ein Sof, or the arousal of desire to come forth into the varied life of being. But in this sense, also, it contains all the potential for content. It contains no content itself, and is therefore called nothing, the hidden light, the air that cannot be grasped.
Thank you, Trudy. Where are you from?
I live in England, but I am German.
Oh, okay. Well, thanks so much for participating today. It's great to have you. This comes from that ancient revered source, the Wikipedia. So, the crown symbolizes that which stands above the head. Remember, the topmost position of the tree of life is Kether, or the crown. So it symbolizes that which stands above the head is beyond anything that can be known by humankind. But it forms a definite link to the mentally polarized disciple. Does that sound familiar? It's phohatic in nature, right? That which it expresses is the highest levels of the energy of Phohat. The crown also has some political ramifications, a field governed by the first ray. In ancient times, when rulers were initiates, the crown of the ruler indicated oneness with the will of the ineffable. Thus, Egyptian pharaohs were recognized by their own people to be the gods that they were indeed one with, at least while acting in the role of pharaoh. Our common symbol for the number one, shown here, which is a vertical line segment, represents the one-dimensional movement of the central point becoming the radius, and thus defining the scope of its own ring past not. This movement is direct, the motion of the first ray, whose form finds expression in the rod of initiation, from which comes the wand of the magician. The causal central point, by means of the radius represented by the wand, reaches down into matter, the many, or the periphery of the circle. It's interesting to note that centuries ago, the word wan, W-A-N, meant both one and wand. Holding his wand aloft, the archetypal magician is the first arcanum of the tarot. Tradition tells us that he is the personification of Mercury, who we are told is one with the sun, just as all white magicians are one with the, quote, will which the masters know and serve. The magician exemplifies yet another reference to squaring the circle, which we discussed in the last webinar. The wand, representing the radius of that circle, invokes the one life to come forth from the central point and infuse the perimeter, which symbolizes the extent of the magician's influence. Remember, magicians always stand at the center of a self-inscribed circle, thus symbolically becoming the point at the center. In doing so, they proclaim themselves as either one with the will of the creative aspect of God, the right-hand path, or as creators expressing their own will, which can lead to the left-hand path. So better watch out, Mickey. Let's take a closer look at the magician Devil's Arcanum. The four elements, air, fire, water, and earth, represented respectively by the staff, sword, cup, and pentacle, represent the world of form, the field of manifestation, and the square that is to be transmuted, here symbolized by the table on which the elements lie. Transmuted by the living presence of the circle of which the wand is the radius. If this arcanum was arranged geometrically, as is our Navajo sand painting, you might remember this from last time, the squaring of the circle would be much more obvious. You would have the four elements, the wand, the staff, the wand, the sword, the pentacle, and the cups in the four corners with the magician standing at the center. Indeed, this sand painting is as much a magician's card as the unwittingly, I'm sure, it is a fantastic representation of the first arcanum. But this act of squaring the circle is not confined to the magician. We can see it in playing out in the entire Tarot Arcana. And this admittedly rough and ready photo of this concept that I had. The aces of the four suits of the Lesser Arcana represent the four corners of the square. The suits themselves make up the four sides. The 21 major arcana symbolize the influence of the circle. The fool would stand in the middle. I forgot to stick him in there. But the concept is the same, that you have the higher influences, those of the spiritual realm, bringing the four elements that make up the personality self into a condition called squaring the circle, which it should in fact be called circling the square. Okay, I'd like to finish up our discussion of oneness by taking a brief look at a few more subjects. The color associated with the first ray is red, but as we are told in Letters on Occult Meditation, true red scarcely resembles the name red, a name intended to blind and mislead. Add to this the fact that red is the esoteric color of the first ray. Orange is its exoteric color, thus linking it with the fifth subplane, the sons of mind. And it becomes even more unlikely that the red we know expresses the vibratory rate of the first ray. In fact, in a treatise on white magic, we're told that the esoteric colors bear no resemblance to their exoteric counterparts. When I searched Alice Bailey's writings for the word red, almost all of the references were to the red of desire, expressions of sixth ray Mars energy. Nonetheless, we must note that as shown in this chart, the highest vibratory rate occurs among the reds, just as the lowest rate occurs with the violet associated with the seventh ray. Unfortunately, well, it's just because we don't know the real keys, the central colors don't line up in that way, though we do have the fourth at the center of the spectrum with yellow. At any rate, there's at least a symbolic connection between red as we know it and the first ray, as is witnessed by the red robes of kings and queens throughout the Piscean Age. Or is this just because Pisces is ruled by the sixth ray? So, what is this esoteric true red of the first ray? My guess is that during this second solar system, it is not part of the visible light spectrum at all, but that it will become visible in the next solar system when we are told the skies will be red. But that red won't be any red we know. We do have a most provocative quote from Dwal Kool that obliquely references this first ray red. And since I just love to hear the different attendees' voices. Could we get someone to read this, please?
Okay, show of hands. Oh, we got one right here. Please go ahead, Scott. Okay, sorry.
I was just going to say you may be self-muted.
Am I there now?
You are.
Yes.
Good, all right. One of the four Lapika lords who stand nearest to our planetary logos is called the Living Serpent. And his emblem is a serpent of blue with one eye in the form of a ruby in its head. Students who care to carry the symbology a little further can connect this idea with the eye of Shiva, who sees and knows all and records all.
Thank you. Now, this ruby red is most certainly the red of the first aspect of spirit. And we'll be revisiting this serpent shortly, so keep your ears open for the next reference. How can you not love DK's writings, huh? When you read something like this, it just astonishes me. Okay, moving right along. The vibratory rate or musical significance of oneness is the root note of a chord. At a more causal level, it could be seen as that median line that you see depicted here called the phase that invisibly equilibrates the line of oscillation. Thus, the silent median line could represent the one non-being and the root note the one being. And when you think that logos means sound, we're not far from the root cause of these cosmic principles. The old commentaries are filled with references concerning the one sound. We're told, for instance, that at the ninth initiation, the one sound of the absolute is revealed. This is four initiations beyond the level of Dual Kul. And this gives just some idea at the level that we're talking about when we're considering the concept of oneness or the absolute, that which lies beyond duality. The etymology of the word one is very diverse. In early times, the word for one often began with the letter A, as in Ayin, A-I-N, which is similar to A-N, the word for one in Old English. And we still have that word, right? An apple, right? It's meaning a singular apple. As we know, A often represents spirit, as in A-U-M. In fact, we often find the letter A conditioning sacred words by appearing as every other letter, like anahata, A-N-A-H-A-T-A, which is the Sanskrit word for the heart center. This phenomenon isn't exclusive to Sanskrit either. Near Santa Fe in New Mexico is a sacred mountain named by the indigenous peoples here called Atalaya, A-T-A-L-A-Y-A. Here's a list of A-punctuated Sanskrit words. The vowel A associated with spirit perforating the substantive world represented by the consonants. You know, in ancient Egypt, when they published any sacred teachings, they just left out the vowels and gave only the consonants. The idea being that only the form was revealed, and that you had to be initiate to know how to animate the form through its vowels. Now, not all A-punctuated words have a spiritual meaning, but as you can see from this list, a whole lot of them do. Okay, one is directly related to or has an affinity with all other numbers, and one is the only number that can make that claim. Geometrically, one is represented by the point in the center of all two- and three-dimensional figures. However, certain qualities of oneness are revealed by some numbers more than by others. For instance, the triangle, the tetrahedron, and the pyramid all introduce the concept of the apex, symbolizing one as God transcendent. The cross, on the other hand, which is intrinsic to the four, accentuates the one at the center, symbolizing God immanent. We can only briefly touch on how the number one manifests in astrology. I'll make my apologies in advance. This is really a once-over, but it's such a profound consideration that we're only able to just highlight a few ideas. The three crosses, the cardinal cross is most closely related to the one of pure spirit. DK says, this is the cross of God the Father, and therefore of the incarnating monad. It is the expression of will or power. Each of the four signs of this cross has its unique way of expressing oneness. In Capricorn we have, like the pyramid, the apex of the mountain. Libra gives us the point between the two extremes, often described as the razor's edge, which would be one point thick, right? Cancer represents the first of the two great gateways, the one and two physical incarnation. And in Aries, we have the initiating impulse. Furthermore, DK tells us, in connection with Aries, which expresses or is the agent primarily of the first ray of will or power, the ray of the destroyer, it should be stated that first ray energy comes from the divine prototype in the Great Bear, that it becomes transmuted into the force and activity of the planetary logos of the first ray. That logos, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, is Vulcan, which DK tells us is, quote, the only planet that manifests distinctly and purely first ray energy. Now, Pluto also manifests first ray energy, but because it's not a sacred planet, I don't think it qualifies for this description that DK gives, which is manifests distinctly and purely first ray energy. If one of you astrologers know for a fact that that the Great Bear manifests through Pluto, let me know, because I would not like to be in error on that point. Okay. I'd like to touch on the geometry of flowers as we move through the numbers. This seems almost fanciful, but it's actually an astonishing study. One of the preeminent authorities in sacred geometry, Keith Critchlow, wrote a fabulous book, 400-page book, dedicated to the study of flowers. He called it the hidden geometry of flowers. There's only a few one-petaled flowers, chief among them the arum and the calla lily. In his beautifully illustrated book, which I was just describing, Keith Critchlow points out that the arum has a, quote, curious similarity to images of the Lord Buddha and his light body, unquote. I can substantiate this. I visit a local temple every Sunday morning, and there's a statue there of a bodhisattva with a very, it's very clear that it's an arum flower that is acts as the aura or the hood around that figure. And then we have the calla lily. When viewed from the top, this unique flower seems to express the circle with a point in the center. Okay, finally in our study of the number one, and perhaps most importantly from the point of view of discipleship, I'd like to talk about the state of consciousness that is most often associated with oneness. This state is called identification. DK tells us, well, let's get a reader for this. Would somebody like to volunteer?
Okay, any hands? I don't see any volunteers yet. Come on, guys. Okay, here we go, whole bunch of them. Lupita, go ahead, please. Make sure you unself-mute yourself. I don't hear.
Finally, could you hear me?
There you go.
Thank you. Finally comes the mysterious process wherein the soul becomes so absorbed into that supreme reality in synthesis through identification that even the consciousness of the group fades out. Not is there known save deity, no separation of any part, no lesser synthesis, and no divisions or differentiations.
Thank you, Lapita. I appreciate that. Where are you tuning in from?
I am in Victoria, Canada.
Oh, fantastic. Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
This quote brings to mind stories of Ramakrishna, who, aside from being one of India's great holy men, was a priest in the Kali temple at Dakshineswar. As part of his priestly duties, he would ritually anoint, offer food to, and place garlands of flowers on a statue of the goddess Kali. However, unlike most priests, performing these acts would plunge him into an ecstatic state. Those looking on would see him at first performing puja to the statue, as any other priest would, but then as his ecstasy took hold, he would begin adorning and anointing himself. His skin would, as many described, shine with a golden hue, and those looking on would be immersed in a powerful presence. His experience, as he related it, after coming out of these ecstatic states, was that he was anointing the goddess herself. This would seem to me to be an example of the state of consciousness DK describes as identification, which we are told is only possible for those who have achieved the fourth initiation. And even at that level, it's a progressive process. Okay, that wraps up our focus on oneness, though we'll continue to consider the relationship of one to each of the numbers as we move through them. Now I'd like to move on to the dyad, which is Greek for the number two, but first let's open the floor for comments and questions. I want to thank you for holding your questions up to this point and for your patience. Does anybody have any thoughts on what has been presented up to this point? Any comments at all about what's been said?
I don't see any comments yet, well, and I don't have any hands yet.
That's
so.
Fine. We'll just wait a minute because people need to formulate their ideas. You know, it's Ramakrishna's in life. In Ramakrishna's life example, we have to keep in mind that when contemplating the concept of oneness, no initiate, DK tells us that no initiate on the planet can identify himself with the consciousness of that identified being who, speaking in the Bhagavad Gita, says, having pervaded the entire universe with a fragment of myself, I remain. So we've been speaking at the highest levels of consciousness during this segment on the number one. So do we have any comments at this point?
No, I don't see any hands. I don't see any comments.
Oh, great. Well, we'll just...
You're doing such a good job
of
explaining.
Oh, that's it, isn't it? Either that or everyone's fallen asleep. Who knows?
Here we go. I've got one comment.
Great.
Don't you think Ramakrishna's hands are in a very interesting mudra, 2 and 3?
That's a really good point. I had not paid attention to that. Certainly, the upper hand is 2. It could be that the 3 fingers are hiding some extended fingers behind them. I can't quite tell whether they're folded over or not. It would be interesting to look these mudras up, which you can do. That top one would be probably very quickly identifiable, especially since this is a section on duality. I tell you what, I will make that my homework for this month and come back with you with something on that mudra. Anything else?
Yes, we have Arrest. Arrest, would you like to go ahead?
Hi, Arrest. How are you?
You're self-muted.
Unmute yourself and you'll have better luck.
There you go.
Can you hear me now?
We can.
You had the symbol of infinity as one form of knot that was related to the one. There are other knots which are trifoils, and there are newly discovered knots which are formed within the toroidal field, and these knots are moving, and in their activation, they activate all the nodal points of both the Platonic solids and the Kepler solids. So I think there is a symbol that's starting to emerge, which is of the one which relates to what I've just stated.
Oh, that's fantastic information. Would you send me a link if you have this information in any kind of document form? I'd love to read about it. You know, it brings to mind the idea that, you know, up to this point, we have the Platonic solids in their static form. So what a perfect revelation that, you know, this toroidal concept of moving knots would reveal a kind of another aspect of the energy of the Platonic solids. That's very exciting. But that's not surprising coming from you, Orest. You're a source of amazing information. Thank you for that. Anyone else like to chip in with some thoughts, or if you have a question about anything that's been discussed?
Here, go ahead, please. Asha?
Yes, I just wanted to say that I love all the references to India. I'm actually from India. I was born in England, but I lived there from the ages of 3 until 9, and I rejected a lot of that, so it's coming full circle to sort of go that route, live in the West, and then sort of embrace all the teachings from an esoteric point of view. And actually my name, I always introduce myself as Asha, but it's actually Asha. And thank you for pointing that out. It's the R sound there too. So it's very, thank you so much. This is interesting.
Terrific. Thank you, Asha. That's one of those words, isn't it? A-S-H, which can be seen as one letter. A. Asha, you should insist that people pronounce your name correctly. Asha. Okay, well, let's move on then. Actually, I would like to repeat this statement because it's quite important. It's from Esoteric Psychology, Volume 1, wherein D.K. says, "No initiate on the planet can identify himself with a consciousness of that identified being who, speaking in the Bhagavad Gita, says, having pervaded the entire universe with a fragment of myself, I remain." Now, this suggests to me that this identified being is someone beyond Krishna, but is in fact someone who Krishna was, that was overshadowing Krishna, much in the sense that the Christ overshadowed Jesus, but possibly even a cosmic being. Because, hey, if no one in the, no initiate on this planet can identify himself with this level of consciousness, you know, we have 7th initiates on this planet. Well, you know, that's the initiation where the choice is made to move off the planet. That's a very, very high level of consciousness. And even at that unimaginable level, this level of identification, which begins with the 4th initiation, is not realized. It's staggering and humbling at the same time. DK goes on to recommend that we guard against rhapsodizing about the one life and suggests that statements such as "I believe in the one life" are paradoxically dual in nature. So as we move from oneness to duality, we're shifting from the real to the familiar, from the realm of philosophic speculation, at least from our point of view, to life as we know it. For duality conditions all aspects of the manifested world. Ironically, we're also shifting from the real to the unreal, which is why the Greeks considered two-ness to be the great heresy. They saw the dyad as contrary to the monad, as matter is contrary to God. It sounds like a kind of esoteric fundamentalism, doesn't it? We'll take a closer look at Greek thought on duality in the next webinar. It's fascinating material. Okay,
hold it.
Okay, that's fine.
Excuse me. We have a comment here from Dorothy concerning the mudra, gesture of banishing, karana, also called the gesture warding off evil. This mudra indicates with the hand stretched out, either horizontally or vertically, palm turned forward, the thumb presses down the middle two fingers like the horns of a yak against an enemy, while the index and little fingers extend straight upward. You can find, I'm going to murder this, Abhaya Mudra, sometimes also as the left-hand gesture.
That's Abhaya, I think. Is it A-P-A-Y-A?
A-B-H-A-Y-A.
Okay, Abhaya. Uh-huh.
And then Akada Yada, and Yama, as well as, I should have just let Dorothy speak, Vajrapani and...
Vajrapani.
Not yet. Buddha Dhammara Vajrapani, are frequently shown in this mudra. Right hand, the two fingers raised, is in the picture. I'm sorry. You want me to unmute Dorothy?
No, that's okay. We got the general idea. Thank you, Dorothy. Am I to understand that the right hand upward extended is the banishment, or is it the other hand? I think it's the right hand. Yeah. Because it was described with the thumb folded
right
over the two fingers. Yeah, yeah.
Right. She says no mic, but she says it's the right.
Yeah, okay. That's fascinating. My guess is that it would help to create the kind of spherical ring pass knot that is encircling this group of disciples, almost like an antenna, for Kali, which is what you're looking at right there, the embodiment of the bliss of Kali and demonstrating through Ramakrishna. Extraordinary photograph, really amazing.
And she says she can't find anything similar to the left hand.
Oh, that's okay. We can't quite see that left hand anyway. So I think that'll suffice. Thank you for that info. That's terrific. Okay. So the first question about the dyad that we might ask is, how does one become two? How did unity first make the leap from sameness to otherness? This ancient sculpture, called the Mask of the Infinite, from a cave in the Bombay Harbor, depicts this transition from one to two. This is not, as it seems, a three-faced deity, but rather it depicts the central one becoming two. Using this piece as an example, Joseph Campbell describes the transition into duality in this way. Whenever one moves out of the field of the transcendent, one comes into the field of the pairs of opposites. One has eaten from the tree of knowledge, and everything becomes dual, male and female, past and future, right and wrong. But still, we might ask, how is this transition made? For an answer, we need to return to the stanzas of Zan in the Secret Doctrine. And I need some intrepid volunteer to read this passage. We have three united verses, and then the sixth verse, which I felt was strongly related to the first three.
Okay, volunteers.
Anyone like to?
We've got some good hands here, so let's go with... Go ahead, Asha.
Okay, I'm an intrepid volunteer. The last vibration, the last vibration of the seventh eternity thrills through infinitude. The mother swells, expanding from within without, like the bud of the lotus. Two, oh, that's pretty intrepid. The vibration sweeps along, touching with its swift wing the whole universe and the germ that dwelleth in darkness, the darkness that breeds over the slumbering waters of life. Three, darkness radiates light, and light drops one solitary ray into the mother deep. The ray shoots through the virgin egg. The ray causes the eternal egg to thrill and drop the non-eternal germ, which condenses into the world egg. This is like poetry. The root of life was in every drop of the ocean of immortality, and the ocean was radiant light, which was fire and heat and motion. Darkness vanished and was no more. It disappeared in its own essence, the body of fire and water, with father and mother.
Thank you very much, Asha. Terrific. Nice reading, too. Did you have any thoughts as you were... Could you mute Asha, please? Great, thanks. Did you have any thoughts as you were... as you were reading through this, any revelations as to the meaning of this stanza? Anything come up? I could tell you were moved by it.
Oh, powerful, almost very poetic, very beautiful. I mean, the whole thing is something to ponder on for sure. The vibration sweeps along, touching, swiftening the whole universe and joining the world, and then darkness radiates light, and light drops one solitary ray into the mother deep. The ray shoots through the virgin egg. The ray causes the eternal egg to thrill and drop the non-eternal germ. It condenses. I don't know what else to say. Those words are perfect.
I know exactly what you mean. It's humbling in that way. Yeah. Thank you for your reading. Does anyone have any comments on this stanza? Any revelations? Or if you're so blissed out by it, you're just unable to speak, I can understand that too.
Everybody is blissed out.
I see, okay. Well, that works.
We do have a comment here.
Great, yes.
Here is the Fibonacci sequence zero. To one egg, to one egg.
Is that Scott?
Yes. Let me let him explain that, because I'm not even sure I read it right. Go ahead, please, Scott.
No, that's what I meant to say. Fibonacci. You have two eggs here, and that when I see that, I go, that's one and one. That's Fibonacci. 0, 1, 1. Mm-hmm. From the eternal egg to the non-eternal. The virgin
exactly.
Egg to the world egg. That's
incredibly insightful, because it isn't what's happening here, the beginning of the process of generation. You know, the fundamental difference between oneness and two-ness, and that which connects them, is the movement from what's called pralaya, which is that state which is just pure being, to the manvantaric apox, which all that means is that the great cycles of time that take us across the line into time and space. Yeah. So there's where we move from the zero of the, as Scott described it, as, you know, this absolute slumbering waters, right? And then to the initiating quality of the first one, and then the actual, what we would call actual from the point of view of manifested, world egg of the second. We're going to be talking about this from the point of view of geometry very shortly. Thanks for that contribution. Very insightful.
Okay, and then we have a couple more comments. From Simon, the first line seems to be referring to the number 7 and is profound relationship to the Vesica Pisces, the mother of creation. And then Orest follows that up, virgin birth Christ within.
Mm. Yes, indeed. The Vesica Pisces is indeed the preeminent symbol of the mother. And we'll be looking at it from the point of view of two-ness as well as three-ness and the infinite manifestations that come from that form. We could do an entire webinar on the Vesica Pisces. All right.
And then one more question from Asha.
Sure.
Can you talk about the meaning of darkness radiates light?
I sure can, and I will. It's actually built right into the webinar here. So let me move on, and I'll be addressing it immediately. So darkness, as here described. Oh, wait a minute. I skipped something. We have to keep in mind that all the language used in these stanzas is metaphorical. Not so much because the writer was trying to poetically veil the subject, but because all languages, especially English, is fundamentally incapable of conveying these truths. So darkness, as here described, is not the darkness caused by the absence of light, which is a darkness that we're used to, right? But is rather a causal darkness that is the source of all light. As HBB tells us in her commentaries on this stanza, the essence of darkness is absolute light. Also, the so-called ocean, which we, you know, generally think of as containing water, but the ocean depicted here is radiant light, which was fire and heat and motion. But even this fire is not fire as we know it, but rather the causal essence of fire. We could call this primordial ocean the ultimate fecundating agent, or as HPB says, the base and source of material existence. Another metaphor, the egg, represented by the circle, is what HPB calls the promise and potency of that which will be. Now there's the zero that Scott was discussing. This is the undifferentiated promise and potency of what is to be. That's before the dot forms at the center, right? That is the germ, which is represented by the point. And HPB describes that as a generator of light and life. So the generator of light from source darkness, right? These are very difficult concepts to wrap your head around. The dropping of the eternal, of the non-eternal germ from the eternal germ could be seen as the movement from the point to the diameter. Right, because you have this quality of dropping, which suggests motion, and in that we have the movement from the first to the second logoi, and thus from oneness to two-ness. In this way, the first polarities come into being, and the first manifestation of two-ness, which could be expressed as darkness in its causal relationship to right. To light. For confirmation of the verity of this concept of causal darkness, we need only look at Rule 9 of the Rays and Initiations, which states, let the group know there is no color, only light. And then let darkness take the place of light, hiding all difference, blotting out all form. So he's hinting at, really revealing, a progressive stages of reality, where you have the level where color manifests, and then when you move up, there is only light, because after all color comes from one light source. And then beyond that, this primal darkness that we've been discussing, right? And he goes on to say that inherently blots out the form world. Though foreign to Western minds, the primacy of darkness is a concept recognized in both Hindu and Buddhist traditions. Here we have a tanka depicting causal darkness, manifesting the wheel of time out of its own essence, right? That's just what we've been talking about, right? When that non-eternal germ drops, one of the things that happens is the wheel of time comes into manifestation. Yeah? So dark and light, which could also be described as water and fire, or the causal feminine expanding from within without to produce the causal masculine, which personified, which when you personify these two, could be characterized as the primal mother and the primal father, which is one with the first logos. These are the first manifestations of two-ness, the first pair of opposites, and thus the first polarities. Michael Schneider states in A Beginner's Guide to Constructing the Universe that the paradox of polarity is that, quote, its opposite poles remember their source and attract each other in an attempt to merge and return to the state of unity. The dyad simultaneously divides and unites, repels and attracts. We find a beautiful example of polarity described in a treatise on white magic. The dual forces on the plane whereon the vital powers must be sought are seen. The two paths face the solar angel. The poles vibrate. A choice confronts the one who meditates. The phrase, the poles vibrate, suggests its magnetic nature, doesn't it? Here we have an illustration of the energy waves of a simple magnet. We might hypothesize that the way in which these waves manifest and interact is universal, you know, not only for a bar of iron, but for all the pairs of opposites. Here it is shown in a crop circle. You see the same idea. It's interesting how when we zoom in on this, it energetically resembles the mask of the infinite. Can you see the similarity? And again, we have a crop circle that describes this one becoming the two. This serves as a reminder that though depicted as such, the true appearance or masks of these deities is certainly not human, for they are great cosmic principles far beyond the human kingdom. They are only depicted this way so that we can relate to them. I mean, how else are we going to do this? But they can unconsciously condition our understanding of deity as somehow being limited by human forms, which is, you know, absolutely not true. Okay. Even though we use the sphere as a symbol of unity, when in manifestation, all spheres have a magnetic polar duality, as can be seen by this rendition of the magnetosphere of the Earth. Here's another depiction. Now, when we consider this principle of two-ness in relation to our own solar system, we find that duality is particularly dominant. the Tibetan tells us the outstanding influence in our solar system is the great cosmic second ray of love wisdom, a dual ray. That is, a ray combining two great cosmic principles and energies. Duality conditions everything we do, even how we incarnate. DK tells us that reincarnation is a joint activity of solar and lunar petries, right? The solar is building the consciousness of the soul self, and the lunar petries are building all the sheaths, right? A dual sound is emitted, which is, quote, the basis of the mantram upon which the ego's, meaning the soul's, cycle of incarnation is founded. A relationship is then set up, described for us in the Pisces section of esoteric astrology. Could we get someone to read this?
Volunteers, intrepid souls. Okay, here we go. Go ahead, Daisha.
Thank you. One fish stands for the soul, and the other for the personality or form nature. And between them is to be found the thread or sutram.
Sutratma.
Sutratma, the silver cord which keeps them bound to each other throughout the cycle of manifested life. Later on, upon the reversed wheel, the personality is brought into captivity by the soul. But for long eons, the situation is reversed, and the soul is the prisoner of the personality.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Where are you speaking from?
Victoria, Canada.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Did you speak before?
No, someone else did.
I thought so. I didn't think that was the same voice.
Well, there are two of us.
We have a contingent up there. That's terrific.
For sure.
All right. Of course, you know, the dual condition described here, it applies to all the signs. It's in Gemini, we have the twins, Castor and Pollux, which represent an airy version of the same concept. So when the personality is brought into captivity by the soul, we are on the path of return, characterized by what is called the dual life of the disciple. One symbol for this dual life is a fixed cross, here being held by one of the prophets at the Chartres Cathedral. I know I shouldn't stop. You know, there's so many wormholes here, but anyone who needs a vacation destination that has an esoteric content would do well to consider this fabulous cathedral. Okay. The vertical line represents the soul, or, you know, spiritual life in general, and the horizontal line, the personality, or the realm of the form world. Notice, though, that both are encompassed by the circle of deity. We'll get into a deeper analysis of crosses in our session on the number four, though the cross very rightly belongs to both the numbers two and four, because there's two arms to the cross. The primary symbol for duality is the simple diameter, symbol of the second logos, which, as we've seen, comes about when the non-eternal germ drops from the eternal germ. In India, he is Vishnu, shown here. Wait a minute, that's Jimi Hendrix, shown here with his five hooded nagas, symbols of wisdom. You know, we have the second ray is love, wisdom, and Vishnu, the nagas above Vishnu's head, since Vishnu is the highest representative of this second ray. The nagas would represent the wisdom aspect. You know, actually, Jimi Hendrix, with his axes bold as love, axes, polarity, was a kind of psychedelic manifestation of the Second Rite. Anyway, now we know where he got his album cover. But back to the five hooded Nagas. The number two has a strong relationship with the number five, demonstrated by the fact that the second element to manifest in the realm of sound or vibration is the fifth, the root and the fifth, thus making up the first duality in sound. In astrology, this connection demonstrates through the close association between Jupiter and Venus. This is, by the way, I brought this slide up a little late. This is the fundamental note and the fifth. The fundamental is in blue and the fifth in green. So in astrology, we have this close connection between Jupiter and Venus, which are the second and fifth ray lords. They are, for instance, co-rulers of the vegetable kingdom, the second kingdom in nature. And at the second initiation, the candidate comes under the influence of both Venus and Jupiter, as well as Neptune. Okay, let's take a look at Vishnu's Nagas here. Notice that there are also serpents arrayed beneath his feet. This introduces a fascinating concept found among others in ancient Egyptian sacred tradition. In these teachings, there were two very different kinds of serpents. Wajit, a deity often seen in the crown of the pharaoh, representing guiding wisdom, and Apophis, representing basically all that was evil. We can see these two serpents as the positive and negative poles of a wisdom knowledge paradigm. The serpent of wisdom, who is one with the will of God, indicated by the fact that the serpent is often depicted encircling the sun, and the serpent of knowledge, used in the three worlds of personality expression, similar to the serpent in the Garden of Eden, Eve's apple vendor, who you might remember lived in the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, one of the fundamental polarities. So you see that on the most energetic level, what we're talking about here is one serpent represents duality and the form world, and the other serpent, the unity of the realm of deity. I find it interesting that the other tree in the Garden of Eden was the tree of life. I'm sure that if we were to poke around in its branches, we would find some version of the serpent of wisdom. DK tells us in a treatise on white magic. Let's get a volunteer for this longer passage. Somebody like to step in?
Intrepid soul. Okay. Please go ahead, Luca.
Let a disciple seize hold of the tail of the serpent of wisdom, and having with its firmness grasped it, let him follow it into the deepest center of the whole of wisdom. Let him not be betrayed into the trap set for him by the serpent of illusion, but let him shut his eyes to the colorful tracery upon its back, and his ears to the melody of its voice. Let him discern the jewel set in the forehead of the serpent whose tail he holds, and by its radiance traverse the miry halls of Maya.
Thank you. You know, many ancient traditions tell, oh, by the way, where are you from? Where are you speaking from?
Slovenia.
Slovenia?
Yes, Slovenia.
Oh, fantastic. Thanks for joining us. It must be late there, is it?
No, it's okay. It's okay.
Oh, okay. Well, thanks so much. Did this bring to mind any ideas or thoughts that you'd like to share?
Well, that we have a chance that the duality, well, it's a little bit deep for must be able to think about it.
Yes, it certainly is. It's a very esoteric passage. Notice how that, remember the serpent that we introduced before, that Scott read about, the passage that Scott read about the serpent that had the ruby in its forehead, or the one eye of the ruby-colored eye. This, I think, is mentioned here as well, right? That's the one you want to grab by the tail, and let its radiance carry you through the miry halls of Maya. I find it to be just a fabulous
just a question.
Old commentary. I'm sorry?
Do you think the serpent and the dragon are the same?
Absolutely. I'm going to speak of that right now, in fact. So let me go to this. Many ancient traditions tell of the double serpent. As an infant, the Greek Heracles throttled two serpents that crept into his crib. But why would he throttle the serpent of wisdom, if that is indeed one of the two serpents? Possibly because for the high initiate, there is a third level of serpent, which DK reveals in Esoteric Healing. And this is what you were just speaking of. He says, the serpent of matter lies coiled. The serpent is transformed into the serpent of wisdom. The serpent of wisdom is translated and becomes the dragon of living light. So there you have the serpent becoming the dragon. Right, and also whenever you see the word translated, you're looking. It's the verb for reaching the state of identification. It's very often related to this quality of beingness, this level of consciousness. So my guess is that the Nagas above the head of Vishnu are in fact dragons of living light. God, what a term, huh? Dragons of living light. Knocks me out. So this brings up an important point about duality. Often, perceived polarities are actually the baseline of a triangle, equilibrated by an invisible apex standing above the two. Right? When you're in the realm of polarity, you experience the phenomena as the other, right? But at a higher level, there's this other unifying apex. Rumi has a short poem that addresses this concept. He writes, out beyond ideas of right doing and wrong doing, there is a field. I will meet you there. We'll talk a lot more about this idea when we get into threeness. Well, folks, we're just 5 minutes out of, so I'm going to have to skip ahead, as I suspected I would, because I want to get in an invocation here. Actually, we're not that far, but I still think we'll skip. Let me skip down to this very important slide right here. There we go. So I hope you've enjoyed our Odyssey from 1 to 2. Here's an updated reading list. Someone mentioned was that you, Orest? I think it might have been. That the key to the universe, which is the by Harriet and Homer Curtis, is available online. Just do a search for it, and you can pull it up in PDF form if you don't want to make that purchase, because it's a, you know, it's a two-book volume set. Let's see, what else? So two of these books are the same as last time, Key to the Universe and Beginner's Guide to Constructing the Universe. And in both cases, if you've decided to read these, just go to the chapters that relate to the number 2, because the entire next webinar is going to be on the number 2. I've also suggested that you read the introduction to Glamour, A World Problem, which is just the most fabulous exegesis on symbols in general. He, I think 20-some pages, I'm not sure about that, but that would prepare you for the next webinar, because I'll be getting into symbols quite a bit at the next time. Okay, someone suggested that I provide a meditation based on the topic of the day. Actually, you could use this meditation during the entire season, which is just simply to choose one of the symbols that we looked at today. And that could even, you know, that could be the point and the circle, point standing at the center of the circle, or the yin-yang, or the diameter, and ponder on what idea suggests itself as a possible source of the symbol. The idea is the idea and the symbol are the most closely tied. And then DK suggests that significances occur to us on the astral plane, and meanings are more, you know, mental and physical plane levels. So think about the how many meanings and significances you can associate with this symbol. It's just an idea if this appeals to you. Okay, I'd like to have a closing invocation. At the end of the last session, we used an invocation that focused on the one life, which is familiar to the faculty of the Moria Federation, because we often close with that invocation. For this session, I've chosen an invocation from Discipleship in the New Age, Volume 1, that expresses itself very strongly in terms of duality. DK suggests that as we meditate on this invocation, that we visualize a sphere of deep electric blue, vivid and living, unquote. Michael, are you with us today?
Nope, just me pretending to be him. Sorry.
Oh, okay. Could I ask someone else to read this this final invocation, and that will do it for the day. Do we have any volunteers?
Yes.
Terrific.
Go ahead, Simon, please.
May the energy of the divine self inspire us and the light of the soul direct. May we be led from darkness to light, from the unreal to the real, from death to immortality. We stand in spiritual being, and as souls, we serve. We stand within the light, and as the light shines throughout our forms, we radiate that light. We stand within the love of God, and as that love streams through and from the heart, we magnetize the ones we seek to aid.
Thank you. What's your name?
Simon.
Simon, right. And where are you speaking from?
Boulder, Colorado.
Oh, great. You're just up the way from me. Thank you for that reading. Do you see how this speaks in terms of dualities, very much in terms of movement, of kind of reversing the movement suggested by the second logos, right? Moving from darkness to light, from the unreal to the real, from death to immortality. This is part of a greater invocation called the Gayatri. And then we're told that we stand within the light, and we stand within the love of God. So this is duality at its highest level. Okay, well, that's it for today. Don't forget to donate a couple of bucks on moriafederation.com, which will help pay the yearly fee for this GoToMeeting account. If you can handle doing that, that would be terrific. And finally, please tell your friends about this webinar. I would really like to see as many virtual faces as possible here. It's still pretty much at the beginning of the series, and so it would be great to have as many people as possible. So if you know somebody who might be interested, spread the word. I'd appreciate it.
And the people who've missed the previous ones, we always have the recordings. They can get the link from you or from us and go catch up on the ones that they've missed.
That's true. It's on Makara, M-A-K-A-R-A. It's one of those A words, right? M-A-K-A-R-A, which is, the name of a divine dragon of wisdom, isn't it? Anyway, we'll be meeting next time on August 17th, and I hope to see and hear you then. So, bye for now, and thanks for attending. Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.